Hello and welcome to Money Talks with Lucan District Credit Union. My name is Paula Maguire and I'm the CEO here in the Credit Union. Today we're going to look at wills, probate and power of attorney. I'm delighted to be joined today by Dermot Coyne and Andrea Clark of Coyne Solicitors. Andrea is the new partner in Coyne Solicitors. You're very welcome, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Paula. We're delighted to be here with you today.
Thanks for coming over. I just wanted to have a chat today to give more information to the listeners here about areas that people know about, but they're not really sure what they are, particularly around wills and probate. I suppose to kick off, Andrea, could you outline why somebody would want to make a will or what the benefit of making a will?
As solicitors, we would say that it's always beneficial for everyone to have a will, and we would feel so strongly about that, we'd urge people to go into any solicitor. Obviously, we'd be delighted to take on that work for them, but to get their will in place for the very reason that we see a lot of circumstances, I suppose, where there's arguments caused between families when there is not a will in place. We would say it's important to have your wishes written down in a document for when you pass away, because then your wishes would have to be respected in respect of your asset and where they are to go. To, I suppose, sit back and think about that. It seems to be very morbid that you would be thinking about what would happen after you pass away. It's to sit down, to think about all your assets and where you want them to go and how you want to provide, I suppose, for your family in the future after you pass away. So I suppose to make the most out of the will, we would say think who would like to be your executors of the will. So executors would be the parties who would administer the will and make sure that your wishes are carried out. We would always recommend that you'd have two executors as opposed to one, just in the event that one executor doesn't want to act or cannot act.
Yes.
And that you actually then sit down after that, write out all your assets, to write out how they're owned, if they're owned jointly or if they're owned by yourself solely, and where you would like them to go, what beneficiaries
so
you would like.
Would it need to be that detailed where you'd have to look at every single asset, or could you just make a general will?
You can make a general will, and we'd see that a lot of time, especially when people have spouses, their spouses, or they have cohabitees, that they just leave a general will, leaving absolutely everything to that person.
Yes.
Where I suppose you need to consider that further is in the event that that person passes away at the same time as you, what happens after that?
Yes.
So, you know, you might want to provide for your children, or if you don't have children, your maybe nieces or nephews. And I suppose consideration would need to be given to inheritance tax rules,
yeah.
You know, to sit down and maybe think about it from a tax succession point of view.
In that case, they'd be better off going and sitting down with a solicitor to discuss it.
Exactly, because different relatives are put into different categories by the revenue commissioners, and you can inherit tax-free a certain element based on the value of what they've inherited.
And would it matter, Andrea, if, say, there was a couple cohabiting but not legally married, would that have an impact if one of the partners passed away? You know, whereas a wife or a husband would automatically inherit, you know, is that the case for cohabiting couples?
With a cohabiting couple, there still are inheritance tax considerations there.
Yes.
You can apply to the court to be treated as a spouse in other circumstances, but in respect of inheritance, no, you must pay inheritance tax on that case as a stranger.
Yes.
So it's important to, I suppose, take consideration of that and be recognizant of that.
Even if they were deemed a common law spouse and have children, that would still be the case?
It is for inheritance tax.
Okay.
It's not for other elements of the Family
yes.
Law Acts, where you can apply under the Cohabitees Act to be treated like a spouse
yes.
in relation to certain assets, but it's actually separate and distinct for inheritance tax.
Yeah.
In relation to that, a lot of, I suppose, unmarried couples would have property jointly.
Yes.
So while if one party passes away, the asset will automatically transfer to the other party, but
yes.
there's still inheritance tax.
Right,
you're
so.
Still treated as a stranger there for inheritance tax purposes, and you can inherit €16,250 without paying inheritance tax. So it still is in Ireland a consideration. There is a benefit in respect of inheritance for being a spouse
yes.
and to actually be married.
Yes. is there a requirement, a legal requirement, to provide for, say, an adult child?
That is actually an area of law that does cause some difficulty in that, I suppose, if there's a reduced capacity for the adult child, then there is, I suppose, more of a duty. So under the Succession Act, what would be deemed a moral duty. So a parent has a moral duty to a child.
I'm just thinking in the case maybe where there's estrangement or that, and where I know it has caused friction. I've
absolutely.
Actually, I'm aware of a few cases, yes, where there is friction, where the parents weren't inclined to leave something maybe to an estranged child. Just wondering where they would stand legally. And again, this is where the will would come into effect.
Absolutely. So if somebody came into a solicitor's office and the solicitor will say to them, who are your children?
Yes.
And there will be note taken, you know, a very specific note, we're not leaving anything to this particular child for a reason. So that,
yes,
note would be there. So it would be up to that child to bring a case under the Succession Act,
yes,
to say that the parent had failed in their moral duty to them, in providing for them. And it would really come down to the court case. I've been involved in these court cases. They get very granular. You have to write out a history of your life.
Yes.
As to why you think your parents had failed in the moral duty and how, I suppose, a court would deem that the moral duty hadn't been failed. For example, if the parents had paid for education and had that child had a profession, that they were well able to deal with,
yes,
to, I suppose, provide for themselves. Whereas it's all on case-by-case basis. If there was a situation where there was an awful lot of assets and this particular estranged child had no assets,
yes,
then a judge would obviously look at that differently too, if this estranged child was a millionaire coming back seeking money.
But these are the type of circumstances where it's very, very important to go get legal advice,
absolutely,
and get your wishes down on paper in a will.
Exactly. If you don't have a will, your estate will pass under the Succession Act, which we have a long time since 1965. They're well-established rules.
That was going to be my next question. Yes. What if you do pass away with no will? What happens?
Yeah, it's there. So the estate will pass as per the Succession Act, even in them circumstances. So, you know, people will say, my will just pass on intestacy anyway. For example, you have three children, so it's going to go to the three children. So why do I need to make a will? It's going to go to them. And I suppose we've just seen cases where, even in that case where it's very even, there's three children, the estate is going to be divided between three, one of the children will say, that was promised to me one day, mommy said that she was going to give it to me.
Yes.
And that child then is disgruntled. And it can cause an argument, whereas if there's an actual will, it seems to cause less arguments. There's an actual will in place to say that my parent has been in, they've considered this, and they're leaving it to the three of us. Then it negates that argument that my parents said they were going to leave it to me,
yes,
because it obviously shows that established they changed their mind.
Yeah, your wishes are very clearly set out.
They're very clearly set out. So if, I suppose, you pass away without a will, you have to look at all your assets and how they're owned. Some assets are owned jointly with another party, so they pass automatically.
Yes.
When you pass away, and the rest of them then, I suppose, if they're owned solely, 2/3 might go to your spouse and 1/3 then divided between your children. Whereas if you actually have a will, you could leave 1/3 to your spouse and the rest to your children if it's just owned solely.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's different rules then about wills and not wills, with legal rights share. The best way to deal with that is, I suppose, to sit down and think about it so that there isn't going to be any confusion when you pass away.
Yeah.
Because, unfortunately, that is when arguments do arise in families.
Yeah.
And there's no ambiguity if there's a will there.
You did touch on the estate. So if somebody does pass away with no will and it goes, their assets and everything goes to the estate, what does that mean exactly?
That means when you pass away, there's a certain stage of when all your assets pass on to other parties. When you pass away without a will, we need to take out a grant of probate. That's, I suppose, intestacy. So it's a grant of administration,
so
which is, I suppose, all your assets go into the estate. So basically, you decide who's going to be the administrators in place of executors, and that's where all your money, your assets sit until they're divided between the beneficiaries.
And is that what probate means?
Yes, and that's exactly. So we can only take out a grant of probate if you have a will made. So it's a grant of probate based,
yes,
on that will. But if you don't have a will, we're taking out what's called a grant of administration. But it's from the same office. It's from the probate office. It's still a similar process, but there's differences involved in it.
Yes. That was actually going to be my next question, because people do talk about probate. And I guess it was just to say, what is probate and how does it work and how long does it take? Because I often hear we would have members in the credit union here who would have passed, and again, you know, their funds go into the estate or...
A grant always has to be taken out in circumstances where there is an asset.
Yes.
Like a house. In circumstances where there's financial assets, credit union account or a bank account, all the different institutions have different rules about how much can be released without this grant.
Yes.
So I believe in the credit unions it was 23,000.
23,000, yeah.
So if there's under 23,000 in the credit union account, that can be paid out without a grant, if that's the only asset.
Yes.
But I suppose we're looking at an accumulation of all your assets. So you can automatically think if there's a house, we will have to take out some sort of grant, unless it's jointly owned by the person who's inheriting it.
Yes.
In which circumstance it can just pass outside the estate.
Okay.
Sometimes, I suppose, people don't have a house. Then you need to look at their financial assets in the bank. How much is there? How much is in the credit union to decide? Or how much is in the life assurance policies? If it meets the threshold of that particular organisation's rules that requires you to take out a grant.
So again, this comes back to you absolutely need to get legal advice on this and go to your solicitor. And obviously the more assets you have, the more
absolutely
complex it becomes.
And something else, I suppose, for your customers to look out for is to consider in respect of their, say, life assurance policies and credit union, their credit union account, who they nominated on the account when they opened
yes.
it. Because a lot of that will just pass automatically when they to that nominee when they pass away. And I mean, if you open a credit union account when you're 18, that person could be very different to the actual person who you
yes.
want to be the nominee on your account when you're in your 60s or 50s.
Well,
and
well,
it passes it. On.
And it's
so,
something yeah. actually, you know, it'll be in our January newsletter coming out. It's where I ask, we regularly remind our members to review your nominee because it does change over time, you know. So like getting married would negate your previous nominee if it was, say, your mother or father or sister or brother, and then getting divorced
absolutely,
as well. We say
yeah.
to people,
yes,
you know, we have had cases maybe where people forgot to change their nominee after divorce
mm-hmm.
and unfortunately they've passed away.
Same
and their
on
ex,
pensions,
their ex has
yeah.
got their funds.
Funds. Pensions and life policies as well are the same. Like, they change as your life changes, and it's something I suppose we would not automatically think about, but it's very important because, as you said, if your ex-spouse was a very acrimonious separation and they're getting all your assets, you mightn't be all that happy that happens.
Well, you wouldn't be happy, no,
yeah.
that's for sure. Just before I move over to Dermot to talk about enduring power of attorney, Andrea, I'm going to put you on the spot here and just say roughly how much would it cost somebody to go and talk to yourself and get a will in place?
At the moment, the charges for wills are €250 plus VAT.
Okay.
There are some... I suppose the more assets, the more complication you have based on time. But generally, wills cost €250 plus VAT.
Yes.
It would be
worth it if you had an idea that it would head off any potential friction in the family or anything else
well,
in the event of your demise.
Yeah, I think any family member that's in the middle of, I suppose, a dispute in relation to probate would say that €250 would be
money well spent. Absolutely.
Yeah.
We'd be
yeah.
happy to say to anybody to go and
absolutely and
listen
it's,
into
yeah.
it, go talk to a solicitor, especially if there is friction in the family as it is.
And we will say that if there's... gets that acrimonious, that there's a court case has to be taken in relation to the estate, the legal fees for that court case are actually taken out of the estate.
Yes.
That they could run into, we couldn't even quantify some stage how much that could cost, so that €250 in circumstances like that, well cheaper and money well spent.
Absolutely. So I would say anybody, particularly with a lot of assets or any sort of family friction, must put that high on their list of to-dos this year.
Absolutely.
In the new year. There's another aspect then to, as you age, maybe fall into ill health, that we have to kind of think in the head about, and that was always enduring power of attorney, what that was and when you should really put that in. Get Dermot to talk about that, because I know there has been changes in that area.
Well, Paula, thank you for having us over here to chat with you. I'm delighted to be here Before I jump into the enduring power of attorney, I want to just add a couple of comments to what Andrea has said.
Yes.
In relation to the wills. A big benefit in making a will is that you select an executor or executors, and you're choosing amongst your family or near friends the person or persons you think are best suited to deal with everybody and deal with all of your assets. And that can be really critical if there isn't harmony in the family.
Yes.
And you're making an assessment of who is likely to carry out your wishes best. Once you make a will, there are only very limited circumstances in which your wishes after you die can be challenged. The first big challenge, and it's the well-known, recognized challenge of 117, where a child has claimed that you have not made proper provision in the will.
Yes.
That really is the black sheep situation, where somebody went off, did something parents didn't approve of, and decided to write them out of the will. The law there is well walked, and it's section 117, and simply the section is one of these very far-seeing sections written in the 1960s legislation, an enlightened era in legislation. But simply, the High Court stands into the shoes of a moral parent making a just decision, and the court makes the just decision taking into account everyone, the
yes.
child that didn't benefit and those that did. They take into account the assets, the circumstances, the health, the age, whether they married well or didn't marry well, or just fell on hard times through educational shortcomings or whatever. So that is the first thing. That is the first big challenge that there is in a will. The other one is that it's not technically executed, and they're rare enough. A big confusion arises around whether somebody can be an executor and a beneficiary. I'm asked this question, I'd say, 1 in 3 times when people come to make a will. A beneficiary is somebody who receives a benefit. An executor is somebody who carries out and fulfills your wishes. The roles are not exclusive. You can benefit if you are an executor. The one no-no is you cannot benefit if you witness. And the reason and logic and law behind that is the witness is to be independent.
Yes.
And you cannot be independent if you also stand to benefit. And those are two things, two reasons why you would go about making the will. First of all, you head off challenges in relation to somebody not provided for. And secondly, you select the person or persons you think best suited. Not everyone is ideally suited to making decisions in relation to properties, especially if there's a fallout amongst the children in the past. So that's all I have to add to wills. Now I'm turning to enduring powers of attorney.
Yes.
And this is an area where there's lots of confusion at present. There's a few myths out there. The attorney part of it has nothing to do with the solicitor. It's from the French word attorney, which means agent.
Yes.
So it's the enduring power of your agent. So you're appointing somebody to look out for you as your agent. And an agent is somebody who can do everything that you can do. The original enduring powers of attorney, they're called EPAs or enduring powers of attorney. I'll call them EPAs, were established under the 1996 Act. And simply, it's a document, it's quite a long document, it's 17 pages, but there's only a few simple ideas in the document. And the person signing or creating it is the donor. So that's somebody who thinks, or their doctor has suggested, it might be a good idea to sit down and create or to sign an EPA. So at that stage, the person is being advised that they are somebody who may be getting on in years, or who may be at risk of losing their mental capacity. Up until April of last year, they went to their solicitor, who sat down, discussed everything with them, and took instructions. And the instructions was the information required to complete the document. And that information was who their treating doctor was, because you needed a certificate from that person. And then you needed names and addresses of near family members. The legislation sets out a strict criteria of persons who must be notified of these documents, of the existence of this EPA. And then everything is signed up. And once the doctor has certified, the notice parties are notified by registered post of the existence of this document. And I always treat a signed EPA as like an insurance disc on your car window. It's a piece of paper. And you hope to never need it or call upon it. And if you don't, so be it. It was some money spent on a piece of paper, and thankfully it wasn't used. If you then lose mental capacity, the doctor will be warning you. It's normally the doctor will tell you this, look, I think you should have you an EPA in place. If you have, you should consider registering it. And then the roles of the parties change. Donor was the person who signed and created the EPA. The attorney is the person who gets the power. When the person loses capacity, the attorney then becomes the driver. They are the person who accepted the role, and the role is to register the EPA, complete the paper process, and then take care of the donor by making the decisions for them. And you've become their agent, their legal agent. That gives you full power, if the EPA is a wide EPA, to deal with everything: financial, legal, social, who can visit them, medical, etc., etc. And so that
it would be fair to say, Dermot, it should be somebody that you really, really trust.
Well, it's trust, and that's why not only must you trust them, but the notice parties have a referee role here. When you do go to register it, it's registered in the wards office of the High Court. So it's registered in the High Court. Ignore the fact that it's called the wards office. It's registered in the High Court, which means ultimately the president of the High Court is the final arbitrator if somebody steps out of line. You appoint an attorney who is somebody that you trust, is close to you, and really has your best interest at heart.
Yes.
It's not a paid job. There's no rewards on this earth for being an attorney. It's a duty of love and kindness to somebody that has honoured you by thinking so much of you that they would ask you to be their attorney if they lost mental capacity.
Thank you, Dermot. That's really interesting. But I am aware that things have moved on since then.
That's the background up until April of last year. Any EPA signed before April 2023 remain valid. They sit out there like that insurance disc. They're not for a year, they're forever, for the rest of your life. And if you go to register them, they are registered in the High Court. So a process is started. The doctor certifies that you're incapable. And it's quite a strict test. It's not just that you're, you know, not up with everything and don't know who the Prime Minister of India is. It's that you do not have a full grasp of what's going on about you, to the point that you're likely to make mistakes that will be detrimental to you. It's not that you make little mistakes, it's that you will work against yourself without knowing it. And once the EPA is when you set about registering it, all the paperwork is sent to the High Court, it's then in being. And that was the regime or the process up until April 23. Now we have a new law which has been coming since 2015, and it's now a system whereby it's been rebadged, and a lot of the process is now taken over by the Decision Support Service, which is part of the HSE. And the thinking behind this, and the good reason for all of this, is to have a central register where the essential services can establish if there are other decision makers out there who are in a position to make decisions for you. And they're to help people. We're all, well, the population is living longer, and people are able to physically live much longer than a generation ago, but our minds are not able to extend out to match the physical lifespan. So the new Decision Support Service is run by the HSE division, the Decision Support Service, and it's broken down into five simple categories. And all of them operate on the same basis. You go online to the Decision Support Service, you fill in the data. It's a central register. And you can opt for one of the five criteria. The first one is a decision-making assistant. And this is the lightest level of support, where somebody is maybe struggling with some of the decisions that need to be made, be it just simple financial decisions around their house, switching providers, banking decisions, little things like that. And they can go online, register, and then they can appoint a decision-making assistant. It's somebody to help.
So the person does this themselves. They can go online and register.
That's it. And it's all new, and people are struggling with it, but it is user-friendly, and it is set up to work. So persevere.
So this could be maybe somebody with a learning disability, or some sort of a disability?
Not so much a learning disability, as we all get older and the world becomes more complex. Some things aren't as easy to navigate.
Yes.
Online banking, renewing this, switching that. It's all, a lot of it is technical nowadays, and it is useful to have somebody to give you a hand making those decisions.
Yes.
Or that can sit in on that. That's the lowest level. The next step up is the co-decision maker, and that's somebody who is on a level pitch with you. They can make the decisions with you.
Yes.
And they can actually, they run beside you and they say, well, this is what you should be doing. And they're making that decision with you, not for you, but with you. It's a progressive scale. The third step is where somebody has lost the capacity to make their own decisions. And again, you go through the decision support service, and then it goes further. It goes to a court appointed decision making representative. So this is a bit like the old EPA, except that you're not capable
Yes.
of appointing the person. The court appoints the person. Doctor certificates are required. Affidavits from various parties are required. And again, just like the EPA, notice parties are served. And the reason notice parties are served is so that everybody is in the loop and they know what's happening. And if they have any concern or objection, their obligation is to stand up and say, no, I'm not happy with that.
Yes.
And let the court know. Another big factor behind this new decision support process is that where people are gaining power under the decision making representative role, they must produce reports. They have to give feedback. In the old EPA, when a power or an EPA was registered, there was no follow-up. The attorney was a lone agent. They could do what they wanted.
Yes.
And unless notice parties jumped up, there was no reeling in of the attorney. The next layer, again, in the decision support service is the designated healthcare representative. And again, this is a court decision where somebody is appointed to make healthcare decisions for somebody. These are life decisions, life-threatening decisions, medical decisions. The final category under this decision support service is the old EPA. So the decision support now steps into the role of the solicitor. You fill in all of the information, you serve parties, your doctor fills in a certificate, you bring the paper to the doctor signs it, and then you upload it to the decision support service. Your solicitor also certifies that you are capable of actually putting this attorney in place. And then it is registered. And like the EPA, it's the insurance desk. It just sits there. But there's a central register. And as people are living longer and more on their own, where nobody knows what's going on, there's a register there that the Gardaí, the hospitals, the support services can access if there's a query about somebody. And that is to protect us all and to benefit us all into the future.
That sounds very progressive. I know it was for a long time just the power of attorney, but they seem to have really recognised that there's various stages. It's not just as simple as switching on power of attorney. There are various stages that people go through.
It is a very comprehensive makeover. This has been in the offing since the Act was passed in 2015. They've only now brought in the decision support service. I haven't researched, but I've no doubt it's modelled on other countries, New Zealand,
yes.
Maybe the UK. I doubt Ireland went out on a limb to write this book.
Yeah, this is designed, it's gradually going to replace the old ward of court system.
Well, I think there's a 3-year workout of the wards office and the wards of court.
Yes.
The wards of court was a wing of the High Court set up under the 1800s Lunacy Act, and there's just a terrible feel to all of that. It's not necessary in this enlightened age at all. And they're getting rid of the wards of court. They want to bring in a much more friendly, useful support service for all of us, for all of society. And that's where it's going. There's no turning back to the old ways. However it is, it will be improved, but it won't go backwards.
That's great information. Thank you, Dermot and Andrea, for dropping in today. You're happy to talk to anybody maybe that has queries or would like to come and sit down with yourselves and have a chat about any of these areas?
Well, we're a long-established law firm dealing with real people
based here in Lucan Village.
Based here in Lucan and further afield.
Yes.
Dealing with ordinary day-to-day private law. We don't do any criminal law, but every other area of law that will cross.
And how can people get in touch? I know they can look up your website.
Well, our website is easy to find. It's dpc.ie. That's www.dpc.ie. I should say, in this day and age where people are communicating more and more by email, it's probably quickest to send in an email, info@dpc.ie.
Okay, thank you. And I know you have a new service, Dermot, that you're advertising, that you can offer deed storage.
We have a parallel business. It's separate to the office, but it's totally driven by knowledge gleaned in the office. It's the Title Deeds Storage Company. The website is deeds.ie, and it arose from a week when there was a free will week back in 2013, and one third of the people making wills, when I asked them where were their title deeds, one third said they didn't know.
Yes.
And from that, I said we need to store deeds. We will this year be rolling out the wills end of the storage, where we will take in the will, copy it, scan it, post back a copy, email back a soft copy, back it up to the cloud, and hold it for a modest fee per annum. It's not a will register, which doesn't work. It's a will storage, which
very
does
good.
Work.
So again, they can find out more information about storage on deeds.ie.
That's it.
Okay, well, thank you very much for dropping in and imparting some of your wisdom, Andrea and Dermot from Coyne Solicitors again. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paula.
Thank you, Paula.
This podcast was produced by Lucan District Credit Union. Lucan District Credit Union is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland.